The Mafia, the Mob, Organized Crime, La Cosa Nostra, just some of the names of a criminal organization which has flourished for decades here in America and has been glamorized in so many ways. My next guest with his book shows how the truth about the Mafia families is very different than the image that's been created. He reveals how and why the five New York families became what they were and how they eventually fell through the work and courage of people, well, such as himself. He tells all this and a lot more, believe me, in Mafia Takedown, the incredible true story of the FBI agent who devastated the New York mob. He is a retired FBI agent. I served with the Bureau as the coordinator of the organized crime branch of the New York Division, and whose efforts directly and through others brought down the hierarchy of the Genovese crime family. Mike Campy, thanks for being here today, Mike.
Thank you.
And let's start with, let's bring a foundation for the listener. The Genovese family, in the hierarchy of the five New York families, how did they rank, how did they rate? And, I mean, people probably remember what was called the commission. Was there a commission existing that the Genovese family were a part of? How did the families interact?
Yes. So, by my experience and recordings with other, not only Genovese members and associates, but other families, Colombo family members and associates, Gambino, Lucchese, the Genovese were viewed as the most sophisticated, discreet, and powerful organized crime family in the country. And so originally, when you go back to when the commission was first established, it was the five New York-based organized crime families and the Chicago organized crime family and the Buffalo, believe it or not, organized crime family. But Buffalo was removed when you had an administrative member of the Buffalo organized crime family planning the murder of other bosses in the New York organized crime to seize additional power. So there, that's part of the stories I provide, are the to cite the hypocrisy of that organized crime life, going back really to the days of Lucky Luciano. And that was when there were two bosses back before the commission was created. It was Joe the Boss Masseria and Salvador Maranzano. And Maranzano orchestrated Masseria's murder through a conspiracy with Lucky Luciano and others. And the agreement with Maranzano was that Lucky Luciano would take over Masseria's organization. And then it was short time after that, I think it was within months, Maranzano felt jealous of how everybody was looking up to Lucky, and he planned Lucky's murder. And Lucky heard about it, circled back, and they killed Maranzano. Commission was created, and the original five families, I mean, the five families today are known as the Genovese family, the Lucchese family, the Bonanno family, the Colombo family. I think that was five, and the Gambino family. But the original founders had different names, and it historically evolves. Again, Bonanno family, Joe Bonanno was booted out of the commission because of his conspiracy to murder others. And then eventually that family name was supposed to be the Massino family. But Joe Massino, who was the boss, and he was convicted in the around 2007, 2003, he then wanted to cooperate with the FBI, so it lost that name, the Massino family, returned to the Bonanno family. So there's a lot there in the book. I do cite a bunch of different hypocrisies as far as murders, where your organized crime family is supposed to come before your blood family. And when you look back, Albert Anastasia, who was known as the Mad Hatter, was the underboss of his organized crime family, which at that time was known as the Mangano family. And the boss was Vincent Mangano, and his brother Phil Mangano was the consigliere. Well, Vincent Mangano disappeared, and Phil Mangano was found shot and killed in Brooklyn. And obviously, Albert played a role in that, and he was escalated to the boss of the family. So there's a lot in the book that cites how treacherous that life is based on these murders. And the reality is that your organized crime family really should not come before your blood family because of the treachery in it.
Yeah, for those who it's attractive to, it's certainly the reality should extinguish that that magnet it pulls people in with. When it comes to investigating the mob, you obviously have to get in to some degree, some way, some shape, some form. At the early stages, are you relying strictly on recordings? I mean, to me, it seems like the mob didn't seem to be a lot very tech savvy because they always seemed to never be aware of how much they were being recorded. But is that the best in, or with the number of people that you have, both from the associates on the street to the capos to the upper echelon, do you look for someone who's ready, willing, and able to crack and get you in that way?
Well, it's understanding your players that you're focused on. And again, organized crime families have hundreds of made members and thousands of associates. Each made member has got to have at least 10 or more associates in the life. And so every day they're discussing illegitimate business. You just have to figure out, because they'll be talking cryptically, what it's involved and how they're generating money. So I really think it's not that complicated to take down a group, maybe initially. But after a while, the people that you generate as whether informants and or cooperating witness, that comes about with the brighter guys in that life because they realize how they were screwed when you start demonstrating or displaying to them evidence, whether it's in a recording or if it's in documentation. They realize that they've been screwed, and what's the purpose of them going to jail for somebody that screwed them? So you can, all you got to do is focus on it. It may take some time, but it should be easy, you know, after a while to generate cooperation because more and more people, and I think it's the brighter guys that cooperate, and it's the capacity of their cooperation, whether it's as an informant or it's as a cooperating witness. Now, again, a cooperating witness is somebody that agrees to testify, and an informant wants to remain, you know, unknown as far as his relationship with his handling law enforcement officers.
And your go-to, or the one that came to you, whichever way it worked out, and you obviously feature him in the book, Michael Cookie D'Urso. Talk about what his story was. What compelled him to be your guy, your key to getting in?
Well, D'Urso was a tough kid. He grew up in the Williamsburg Greenpoint section of Brooklyn. He worked at a restaurant downtown Little Italy for a guy named Joe Zito, who was a member of the Genovese family. Initially, he was just a busboy or whatever, but as he worked, he experienced organized crime members that frequented this club, including the John Gotti, who liked D'Urso. D'Urso was somebody who was tough, did not take anything from guys on the street, was a fighter, was strong, could bench over 400 pounds at some point in his life, consuming steroids. And so you had a guy, Sammy Meatballs, that also was in that same crew as Joe Zito, that would maintain operating from outside this restaurant on Grand Street. And Sammy Meatballs took a liking to D'Urso. So D'Urso, you fast forward, D'Urso's borrowing money from Sammy to put on the street, making good money as a loan shark. And you've got one of his customers, or is a guy named Carmine Polito. And what Carmine Polito did was, Carmine Polito was a degenerate gambler, and he wanted to be released from being under D'Urso and Tino Lombardi, who Tino Lombardi was D'Urso's cousin. And because he was such a good customer, D'Urso and Tino did not want to release him to Ali Shade's crew. Joe Zito, Sammy Aparo, Ross Ganji went to bat to support D'Urso's request to maintain contact and control over Polito. And what happened one night at D'Urso's social club in Brooklyn, Polito, who had previously attended D'Urso's wedding 8 months before, orchestrated D'Urso and Tino's murder at this social club. And so with Polito's cousins and others, Mario Fortunato, at this club gambling, they shot D'Urso in the head. The gun was too close to his head. The round went immediately down the skull, down his neck. They thought he was dead. And then they shot and killed Tino Lombardi. They fled the social club, denying that they were there. the police were investigating. They were unaware, the shooters, Polito and others, were unaware that Durso survived. And because of all the cooperation that was going on at that time, the organized crime families, Genovese family, did not want Durso to retaliate against Polito and others at that time. He wanted to murder them. He was told to be patient. He will be able to murder them in the future, but not at this time because of the cooperation. And so that pissed Durso off. Polito still was supposed to, they were trying, we were making numerous recordings with Durso, but getting to when Durso went to cooperate with me, a few years later, Durso was operating, you know, a gambling office, or he had bettors at a gambling office, and the individual taking the bets was an individual named Johnny Zero. You can't make it up. That was his true name. And Durso had some bettors that habitually lost. And if you can imagine Zero realizing these guys always lose, rather than record the bets, which is his role and function in a gambling office, he put these bettors' bets to the side as though he would collect their money from losing bets. Well, the bettors won. And Durso went to collect, and Zero, being a friend of Durso's and Durso liking him, told him what he was doing. Durso thought, oh, that was pretty wise, so I'll give him a week to come up with the money. It was about, I think, about $30,000. Well, what Zero did was he repeated that process. And so now it was like up to maybe $60,000. When Durso went there, he told him, you know, he did the same thing. He begged for some additional time. He put his boss on the phone. His boss's name was Castellano. Matt Castellano, Durso believed that this is probably related to a Gambino-controlled gambling office, and so he gave Zero a beating over the phone. Castellano directed Durso to come to a location to collect a portion of the money. I think it was about $10,000. As Durso collected this $10,000, and again, there's more detail in the book, he was leaving Castellano, and he gets a call from an unknown male on his phone. And this unknown male, in a very disrespectful manner, told Durso, don't you ever touch my guy, meaning Johnny Zero. And, you know, Durso was pissed off with how this guy was directing him to have his old man, meaning I think Sammy Meatballs or Joe Zito, to meet with this unknown at an Upper East Side restaurant. Durso hung up the phone on the guy, went back to the gambling office where Zero was, called this unknown male back up on the phone, and then proceeded to give Zero, I can't beat your guy, and proceeded to give Zero a beating over the phone. As he left, he got called by Sammy Meatballs to immediately come down to Little Italy to meet with him, and that's when he learned that the person on the phone was a guy named Frank Farby Serpico, who was the acting Genovese boss at that time. And Alan Longo, who was the street boss, who was communicating with various capos in the Genovese family and soldiers, details of what the boss, the acting boss, was directing them, he came to Sammy and said, that was Frank Farby Serpico. Nobody knew Serpico was the acting boss of the Genovese family. Even members of the Genovese family, including Sammy Meatballs and other capos, they didn't know this. It was so discreet. And so Farby wanted Durso to be killed. When you really look back on it, who was at fault was Zero. And Zero was under Farby and Castellano. And it was like, why do you want Durso killed? Durso wasn't stealing from you. Durso. And so the logic of what Durso was trying to do was facilitate a sit-down between the Gambino family, because he thought it was a Gambino operation, having the individual named Castellano involved. And at that same time, when Farby wanted Durso to be killed, I had gone out to see Sammy Meatballs, or a short time after that, because I had separate information of a threat to Sammy Meatballs' life. And Durso came down that same day, saw Sammy, and asked what's wrong. And Sammy identified the fact that Campy came to see me today. He was like, who's Campy? And he said, FBI. And Durso's thought was that, was I corrupt? Was I with the Genovese family? And Sammy said, no. Campy's honest. Campy was the guy that put Jimmy Ida, Barney Belomo, Mickey Domino, and others in prison. And that was the acting administration on a prior investigation I did. So Durso was thinking at that point, if he wants to cooperate, how does he meet Campy? And that evolved. And it goes through it in the book. And we were only supposed to, when, again, there's complexities to it, but when I met with Durso, our projected operation was supposed to be only 6 months. From June of 98, we thought, to December is when we could address his cousin's murder, the bank robberies that these individuals were involved in, and other crimes. But because of Durso's sophistication and the respect that all these other members and associates of other families and Genovese family had with him, we ended up going close to 3 years and really devastating indictments as a result of Durso's cooperation.
Which is what you will read when you read Mafia Takedown, the incredible true story of the FBI agent who devastated the New York mob. That devastation includes bringing to an end the crazy act of Vinny the Chin Gigante, and you'll read all about that as well. That was a charmed life when you think about this. We have to wrap up here, but here's a guy who messed up the hit on Frank Costello, which would have been the end for anybody else. He managed to get through that and get to where he wound up for the time that he was there. But, well, you brought that to an end that he was hoping would never come about. So that's just some of the stuff you're going to read. And reading Mike's book, I keep thinking of this quote from John Cleese of Monty Python when someone asked Cleese about writing comedy. Well, the beginning and the end are the easy parts. That damn middle, that's the pain in the ass. Same thing with the investigations. You can't plan on this because you never know what you're going to find in the middle and where that's going to take you. But you find out that Mike was always aware of the path. He had the courage to take the path, and he brought the end to a lot of people who many think are glamorous and even heroic. But the truth is, they would have knifed each other in the back and not have a regret about that. You learn about the family. You learn about the procedures, the policies. It's all there in Mafia Takedown, the incredible true story of the FBI agent who devastated the New York mob. Mike Campy, thank you so much for the revelations and the lessons that everyone's going to learn from the book. Plus, you know, there's the fun stuff with the Hollywood connections and all that and more. So great job with the book in such a concise way, organized way, and a most importantly, truthful way. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.